Thank you for having me with you today. It's a delight to be here. In his book, Jesus and the Forces of Death, Matthew Thiessen argues that Jesus does not abolish the ritual purity system. Rather, he abolishes the force that creates ritual purity in the person he meets. In so doing, Thiessen contributes an important argument to the study of Jesus in ritual purity. By shifting the target of Jesus's manifestations of divine power from ritual cleansing to the very sources of impurity themselves. Yet, at least when it comes to the Gospel of Mark, Thiessen's contribution needs some further nuance, not concerning the forces that create ritual impurities, but regarding the he that abolishes it. Put simply, in his mission to destroy defiling forces, Jesus doesn't act alone. In fact, in at least one instance, namely the story of the hemorrhaging woman, he doesn't act at all. Rather, as I've recently started telling my students, healings in Mark are more often than not group projects. Put more technically, and contrary to what scholars commonly argue, it's not the norm in Mark for Jesus to function as the sole active agent who unilaterally heals a passive character. Rather, Mark more commonly portrays forms of what I call co-agency. That is, multiple characters coordinate their abilities and their actions to achieve healing. Jesus is, in such scenarios, one actor. Admittedly, the unique Son of God who possesses God's power to heal, but one character in unpredictable partnerships of shared action. As part of a larger project that focuses on disability and human agency in the Gospel of Mark, I will, in what follows, focus our attention on the story of the so-called leper in Mark 1:39 to 45. And I'll argue that Mark portrays the man with the skin condition, Jesus, and potentially priests manifesting cooperative forms of combined agency to accomplish this multi-layered healing process. In closing, I'll discuss the significance of these observations for reflections about Wesleyan biblical theology, just a little. So, a quick overview of Mark 1:39 to 45. In Mark 1:39 to 45, Mark narrates, according to the wording of the NRSV updated edition, the cleansing of a man with a skin disease. The description translates the single term lepros in Greek. According to Mark, the man desires to be free from his lepra. That's the Greek term for the skin condition. Evidenced by his initiative to go to Jesus and to plead for cleansing. In response, Jesus acts on his emotions, either compassion or anger, depending on the manuscripts, by touching the man and commanding that he be cleansed. The lepra leaves immediately and the man is cleansed, katharizo in Greek. Next, Jesus warns or rebukes the man before casting him away and instructing him to tell no one. If such were the entire story, the matter of agency would be fairly straightforward. The man acts by going to Jesus and requesting cleansing, and Jesus, in response, exerts his agency to remove the lepra and make him clean. Yet Jesus also instructs the man, quote, "But go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them," end quote. With this instruction, Jesus introduces a potential third active agent in the continued process of the man's cleansing, namely a priest. Jesus is there, not, therefore, the sole active agent who alone accomplishes this man's cleansing. To explain why I think this is important, I'll take a short detour through some thoughts on human agency in the Gospel of Mark. It's become common for scholars to argue that characters with disabilities in the Gospels lack agency, and I'll unpack what I mean by that in a little bit. Concerning such characters, scholars seem to presume an atomistic or an individualistic model of human agency, often in all or nothing terms. An individual character either demonstrates agency or does not. For example, Louise Lawrence writes in her excellent study of sensory disabilities in the New Testament Gospels, that characters with disabilities are everywhere but nowhere, and that no meaningful identity, agency, or complexity is attributed to them by the gospel writers, beyond formulaic and flat character traits. Throughout her work, she writes of persons with disabilities having agency lost, muted, or eclipsed, which can be equated to being present, but helpless, hopeless, and passive in their disabilities. Likewise, in an article that focuses partly on the agency of impaired persons in Mark, New Testament scholar Jamie Clark Soles discusses several texts. About the blind man in Mark 8:22 to 26, for example, she claims, "Notice that he does not come by his own agency." And she adds, "People take him to Jesus. Jesus takes him somewhere else. Jesus acts upon his body and tells him where to go or not to go. The man appears as reactive rather than proactive." She adds, "Persons with disabilities often experience this violation of boundaries." Similarly, in her study of healing female bodies in Mark's gospel, Zoradzai Dubé argues that Mark attributes agency to male characters but denies agency to women. Concerning Peter's mother-in-law, for example, Dubé writes that her body is complicated, powerless, and unable to help herself. She adds that Mark, quote, "seems to use cultural stereotypes that her physiologically weak body is crushed under the weight of illness and needs a male healer, Jesus, whose power transmits to help her helpless body," end quote. Ultimately, Simon's mother-in-law, according to Dubé, has no or shows no agency. She's incapacitated due to her weak, feverish female body. Jesus, according to Dubé, a male with capacity to heal, exercises that capacity by imposing power on her body to restore her to fulfill gendered domestic duties. These brief examples illustrate my point. Scholars writing on disability often frame agency as something that an individual character either does or does not manifest, often in all or nothing terms. I submit, however, that Mark's depictions of human agency are more complex than scholars typically recognize. First, I need to specify, at long last, what I mean by agency and to explain the models of human agency that I have in mind. My understanding of human agency in general, and agency with respect to disability in particular, changed significantly when I heard a paper by philosopher Kevin Tempe delivered at the Wesleyan Philosophical Society meeting in 2018. It was in a town called Cleveland, Tennessee. At the time, I was a graduate student, and I stayed, as an aside, at a very questionable hotel that we could barely afford, and I'll never forget that night. Just the conditions were not ideal. However, I digress. In this, in his now published work, philosopher Kevin Tempe defines agency as the capacity of a human to achieve something and their enactment of that capacity. So the capacity and the enactment of that capacity. So following Tempe's lead for this paper, I view agency simply as what a person can do and what a person will or does along with what or might do with that capacity. What a person can do along with what that person does, will, or might do. What Tempe so profoundly argues is that with respect to disabilities, one cannot view human agency as an atomistic phenomenon. It is rather a relational phenomenon. More specifically, he argues that human agency is socially and ecologically dependent. Put modestly, certain capacities are intrinsic to an agent, to a person, but the ability to exercise those capacities actually depends on social environments. In Tempe's more ambitious take, he even goes as far to argue that what an agent can do, that is, their very capacities, are dependent at least partly on social environmental factors. He uses a number of examples to show that changing a person's environment can actually change their capacities. For the sake of time, I'll just use one or two examples. Many with Parkinson's disease, for instance, experience something called akinesia. That is, inhibitions in movement or slowness of initiating and maintaining movement. Yet different social and environmental influences have potential to change a person with akinesia's ability to initiate and sustain bodily movement. This is known as kinesia paradoxa, the sudden transient ability of a patient with Parkinson's disease to perform a task he or she was previously unable to perform. For example, a person can temporarily gain the ability to initiate movement in response to social cues, like verbal commands from another person. Concerning environmental influences, medical publications include remarkable examples of kinesia paradoxa in which people with Parkinson's who cannot walk temporarily gain the ability to stand and run to safety in response to a life-threatening stimulus, like a fire or earthquake. You can actually read stories of people who use wheelchairs and cannot walk, finding the capacity to stand and run out of a building in response to a fire alarm. In such examples, which can be expanded to include other disabilities, including neurodivergence, for example, research shows in the bits that I've read about it, that you can actually change in learning environments in ways that help students with neurodivergence gain executive function that they might not have in other environments. But my point is that in such cases, a person with a disability lacks some capacity, whether physical, intellectual, or some combination of each. Yet social and/or environmental influences transform the person's agency, enabling them with the capacity to do something they could not do before. But there also exists another way of thinking about human agency as a relational phenomenon. Social psychologist and constructivist theorist Kenneth Gergen characterizes two types of normative agency, the ways we normally think about human agency. And he's referring to contemporary North American societies. One he labels causal explanation, which is held by most social scientists. It holds that human actions and changes occur because of external forces impinging on them. That is, we do what we do because environmental influences lead us to do those things. A second view, Gergen labels voluntary agency, favored in daily relations and in courts of law. People have freedom in this view to make moral choices and to make decisions about their lives. They have complete freedom with irrespective of environmental influences. Gergen argues that normative models of human agency fail, both of these models fail to recognize what he calls the fundamental significance of co-action in human affairs. He proposes instead a model that places coactive confluence in the center of concern. For Gergen, deliberation and action should be viewed not as that of an individual or a collection of individuals, but as relational performance or relational action. One can find examples of coactive confluence or relational performance in disability experiences as well. Consider, for instance, when a translator signs for a deaf attendee in an academic conference. The presenter and translator function together as co-agents. The answer to the question, who is sharing with the attendee, gets murky. The same is true in reverse. If I join an event in a deaf community, I'm disabled by my inability to interpret signed languages. I depend on the relational performance of signers and translators working together. Similarly, for those whose conditions require them to communicate with supported typing, a disabled person's agency may merge with some technological apparatus and a human assistant to produce messages. In sum, multiple actors and multiple agents, alongside, in that case, technological equipment, converge to form an assemblage of shared agency, to produce communication. Such examples blur the distinctions we often construct between seemingly different individual human agents. Finally, if I may be permitted to share from personal experience, I offer an example from my own life, and I dabble in a little bit of reader response criticism, I guess. I have an autoimmune deficiency that makes me vulnerable to certain illnesses. When ill, I often run fevers that are quite high for an adult, and it can be fairly, excuse me, fairly incapacitating. One could say that I, as an individual, experience loss in my agency. I lost my place. I'm not getting emotional or anything. Dramatic pause there. I experience a loss in my agency due to a loss of my capacities. Yet if we zoom out to my home, to the household as a whole in which I live and am one family member among four, each member of my family then becomes what Gergen calls a relational performer, part of a collective. Sickness robs one agent of the capacity to fulfill household functions, like taking out the garbage or shoveling snow. Adjustments are made to fill the gaps in my agent, sorry, excuse me, the adjustments are made to the household as a whole to fill gaps in agency that my illness opens up. At the level of the individual, my febrile condition robs my abilities in my daily functioning. Gaps in my own agency and my gaps open up in my own agency, and family members fill them so that I can say, eat a meal. So at the level of a household and the functioning of the system of the house, when one person gets sick, the agency of the household suffers and someone has to fill in gaps opened up by my loss of agency. But even on an individual level, normally I can prepare my own meals and eat them. But when I have a high fever, I actually rely on someone to bring me food to consume. We all become together relational performers, co-agents in the process of providing nutrients to my body. These varied examples support an important point that I want to establish today before moving back to Mark. Human agency can't be reduced to individual autonomous agents. Agency is, rather, a relational phenomenon. Now, let's return to Jesus' healing of the lepros, which I'll discuss in painfully short fashion. The story begins not with Jesus' action, but rather with the man with the skin conditions manifesting his own agency. He goes to Jesus, where in Leviticus 13, in the first couple of verses, they instruct that a person with lepra, with a skin condition, must be brought to the priest by another. Although in Leviticus 13 and 14, there are differences between someone being brought to a priest and someone bringing themselves. There's multiple accounts there. Mark narrates the man actively going to Jesus on his own. Yet this man can neither transform his dermatological condition nor declare himself clean. He has, in other words, exerted agency, and he's done what he can do, but he's also reached the limits of his agency, signaled by his kneeling before Jesus, according to most manuscripts anyway, and his acknowledging Jesus' capacity, stating that Jesus is able, dunamai in Greek, to cleanse him if Jesus so desires. At the borders of this man's agency, Jesus acts on his own capacities. With a touch, he says simply and bluntly, "Be made pure." Katharistati. The combination of Jesus' touch and word is, fittingly for Mark's gospel, immediately efficacious, because everything is immediate in Mark. The lepra departs. The man's dermatological condition is healed. Yet if one isn't sufficiently attentive to the Levitical matrix in which all of this occurs, one may miss an important point. In healing the skin condition, Jesus has also reached the limits of his agency in this story. Although he's removed the lepra from the man's skin, he's not a priest. Jesus cannot, therefore, conduct the requisite examination and pronounce the man ritually clean or pure. If one understands agency as the capacity to do something and one acting on that capacity, Jesus here lacks the capacity to make the man ritually clean. As in Leviticus 13 to 14, and to borrow again from Thiessen, quote, even after the underlying condition causing impurity disappears, the ritual impurity still lingers, end quote. But as a non-priest, Jesus is unable again to make the man ritually clean. Thus, Jesus instructs the man to go to the priest, which requires him to exert again his own agency and to make offering as a witness to them, which is an ambiguous way that Mark narrates it. Although both Jesus and the man act on their capacities, they are dependent on the priest to accomplish the ritual cleansing and to finalize the process that Jesus began by healing the man's skin condition. In sum, from beginning to end, the story does not describe Jesus single-handedly healing a skin condition solely by his own agency. Rather, Mark narrates a remarkable tale of interdependence, in which Jesus himself functioned as one interdependent partner among others. To be sure, I should establish this, Jesus offers unique authority and healing power and serves as the divinely sent missing link to provide agency needed to cure the skin condition itself. Even so, in this story, Mark depicts what I call co-agency. Human agency understood as a relational phenomenon. In this particular story, what one finds is akin to Gergen's descriptor of relational performance. Rather than locating agency in one individual or another, Mark portrays multiple actors coordinating their agency together to achieve physical healing and ritual cleansing for a man identified as lepros. In closing, it's common for interpreters of the Gospels to argue that Gospel writers portray characters with disabilities as having no agency, in contrast to Jesus, who acts as an active agent to heal unilaterally. In contrast, I argue that Mark portrays the human agency involved in healing stories with more complexity, and I focus on the healing and cleansing of the man with a skin condition as a focal point. In particular, I argue that Mark depicts multiple agents, the man described as lepros, Jesus, and potentially a priest, coordinating their agency in a relational performance, in co-agency, to achieve healing and ideally ritual cleansing as well. Finally, I foolishly offered to offer some thoughts in the direction of Wesleyan theological interpretations of Scripture, since this is a Wesleyan Studies conference. I say foolish because there's not a lot of time for this, but a couple of thoughts in closing. First, I think that the witness of Mark's gospel concerning agency can inform how we think of sanctification and holiness in a couple different ways. Sanctification and holiness are moral metaphors drawn from ritual purity frameworks, the same frameworks in which Jesus is living and conducting his ministry. Inasmuch as healing and cleansing are group activities, I think such coheres well with Wesleyan understandings of sanctification, which has been viewed as a group effort, at least since early Methodist class meetings, band meetings, and societies. Concerning disability experience in the church more particularly, as one of my colleagues has recommended, when we talk about disability and sanctification in particular, we run into challenges. As my colleague Jeff McPherson, who gave his paper in here earlier, recommended provocatively suggested in a paper he's written, when we might begin to think about disability and sanctification, like Gergen and like I'm trying to do here, more in terms of coordinated relational performances than we have in the past, or at least that we do in my context. We could ask, for example, how a person with dementia, who has lost a sense of their past self and perhaps in some ways their current self, how can that person be sanctified if they find themselves unable to participate in the means of grace themselves. Similarly, we could ask the same about people with intellectual disabilities who are shockingly often denied baptism on the basis of their inability to make an informed confession of faith, or of people who have suffered strokes and have lost a range of capacities that would enable them to participate alone in the means of grace, or on their own in the means of grace. We may find possible answers, I propose, in closing, by not viewing such members of Christ's body as individuals with or without capacities, but rather as one part of a larger assemblage of actors coordinating our agency together, filling in gaps for one another, and participating in Christ's Spirit, not merely to help an individual find holiness, but to help the full body of Christ grow in perfection, grow toward perfection in love. Thank you.